Now many who had thought to imitate them, too frightened by the fate of their friends, remain resigned, all energy destroyed, growing poorer each year, expecting no deliverance in this life. Others looked toward China. "We were not ill-treated in this way when the Chinese were the masters," they said. "Will they come back? Maybe, but when? We may die before." And so, in the evenings, around small fires in their miserable huts, these women, whose tears have reddened their eyes, gaze before them in the dark, picturing the range after range of hills between them and the land where the Lhasa troops have driven away their old suzerains. The distance which separates their country from that certainly not perfect, but more hospitable, land, is not great, but how is it possible to travel quickly without being detected, if one must take the grandmother who walks so slowly, the little ones so soon tired, and the infants who must be carried, and then, what of the ass and of the only cow, whose loss would mean utter ruin for those who would already be compelled to leave so many things behind? How sorrowful was this prosperous summit! I spent the night in a house where thoughts such as I have mentioned haunted the minds of my hosts. The husband and his wife were other ill-assorted as to their age, and my foolish companion repented bitterly for days having mistaken the rather young man for the son of the housewife, whereas he was her husband. The grandmother knew that, once she were dead, the couple would try to escape with the children from their jail. The poor old thing, in other circumstances, would certainly have liked to live longer, but now she wished to die, so that her children might be free to start toward happiness, or at least a lesser misery. She wished to die, but she, too, dreamed of happiness, and as she was not to know the earthly one which perhaps awaited her family, she begged the Lama at night, when the others had retired to sleep, to perform the rite which would bring her a happy rebirth in Nabdivo Chen, the Western Paradise. Her daughter was a kind-hearted woman. She did not, of course, desire the end of the tottering, white-haired grandmother, nor did the good young husband. Yet, with the increasing poverty and the taxes and I could have wept. How heartrending was the sorrow of these humble folk. It is on such occasions that one would like to be a god and to have at one's command an inexhaustible treasure of welfare and happiness to pour out to all alike, intelligent and simple-minded ones, so-called good and so-called bad ones, so that all should smile and rejoice. Why could I not flood with true felicity that melancholic Tashitsi, the prosperous summit? I started a little before daybreak, missed the road in the darkness, and did not cross the river as I ought to have done. When I became aware of it, the bridge was far behind. To retrace my steps might have attracted the notice of some servants of the Zong. I did not like to risk it, and so one way only remained, to cross in the water. The stream flowed rapidly, it was large and deep but clear. One could see the bottom, and did not risk losing unexpectedly one's footing, as happened to me in the upper course of the Mekong during a previous journey. On the whole, the crossing had nothing that could frighten Yongda nor myself, who had many times, on horseback or on foot, forded foaming torrents. But the banks were widely scalloped with thick ice which told of the temperature of the morning bath with which the deity of Tashitsi meant to increase our comfort. I went upstream looking for a ford, and reached a fork of the river. The small branch was shallow, nearly frozen over. But, for that very reason, the passage was still more painful. In several places the frozen sheet broke under me and I fell amongst splinters of ice which cruelly cut my bare feet. Then followed the real bath, with dress lifted up and the water just a little lower than my hips. How welcome would have been a warm Turkish towel when we reached the stony shore. Such luxury, of course, was quite far out of reach. True, I had in my bag a root mean square towel, but I used it only when in hiding. Tibetans do not dry themselves after crossing a river, or, if they do, they use a flap of their wide robes. I tried to imitate them, but as soon as it became wet my thick dress of coarse wool stiffened and froze. We went along the river till noon, we then felt hungry and deemed it wise to have a meal before leaving the valley, for we could not guess if water would be found soon on the hills. previous experiences had taught us the torment of remaining 36 hours without drinking. We preferred to avoid risks of that kind. A torrent crossed our road. Once upon a time, in a dreadful rush, it had rent and carried down the mountain and covered the plain, far away, with countless rocks and boulders. Now, at its winter low water level, it divided in several rivulets which went winding among the obstacles accumulated in the days of its strength. I hastily collected whatever dry twigs or cow dung I could find among the stones, and Yongdan lit a fire. Foreseeing greater hardships than ever on the desert road of the high passes, we decided that day that a specially good meal was required, first the soup, then the tea. As a rule we had only one course, either soup or tea. The ordering of the menu was mine. Tibetans begin with tea and end with soup. The soup, under what name could it appear on a bill of fare? Would potage vatel do? I disclose the receipt. From a bag of the most orthodox local fashion, that is to say, greasy and black with dirt, I take out a small piece of dry bacon, the gift of a kind-hearted householder. My young companion cuts it into a dozen tiny bits, which he throws in the pot full of boiling water, then a pinch of salt, and a sigh, ah. If we had a radish or a turnip. But we lack these delicacies and the minute slices of bacon dance alone a lively jig in the boiling broth, a turbid liquid the smell of which reminds one of dishwater. Nevertheless, that scent is not unpleasant to the needy vagrants which we have become. Pure air and long tramps are the best appetizers, and we have eaten nothing since the meager soup, with turnips but without bacon, that our host had given us the day before. Now a few handfuls of flour beaten up in cold water are thrown in the pot. A few minutes later we begin to eat. How particularly good is the soup today? Really delicious, but as, in spite of my long stay amongst Tibetans, I still keep a vague remembrance of French cooking, I add, my father's dogs would never have eaten such a thing. I laugh and extend my bowl to have it filled again. Now it is the turn of the tea. I tear a small piece of the hard compressed brick made as much of branches of wood as of tea leaves. It is crushed into the water, salt and butter are added. It is like a second soup, all the more because we add sampa in our bowls. Now the lunch is ended and we feel perfectly refreshed, capable of climbing as high as the sky. We look boldly to the first range silhouetted against the horizon and behind which we shall meet so many others. We have loaded our bags upon our backs and hold in our hands our long pilgrim staffs. Let us go. I am entering a virgin country and only a few natives have ever contemplated the scenery yonder, which I shall see this very evening. We found a hamlet higher up, in an immense upper valley that ascended slowly toward distant ranges, where it became a desert covered only with grass and shrubs. At first we could see trails followed by cattle keepers in the summer. But soon they disappeared under the grass or in the stony patches, and we were left to our own cleverness to find our way. Once we discovered, far away at the foot of the hills, an intermittent smoke. It might be Dokpas encamped there for the winter, or, as the smoke looked so white, perhaps it was the vapor of soft hot spring, as there are a number of these in Tibet. To go to that place would have taken several hours, and I could not afford this. Although the weather was fine, snow seemed to be expected before long by the people of the country, and I was anxious to be quickly over the first high pass at least. I therefore pushed on, going straight toward the ridge I could see before me. The slight slope over which we were proceeding was not flat ground, for hillocks, miniature ranges, and ravine springs cut it here and there. We plunged into one of the latter, and found its bottom filled with the frozen water of a torrent whose slippery surface made our progress difficult. When we emerged we saw that the large valley turned aside. We had been told to follow a river, but now we saw two only very far down in a gorge, and another which wound close to us amongst short grass and moss. The information we had gathered mentioned also a Dokpa's camp, deserted in the winter, where we could spend the night in shelter. I was very desirous to reach it, for at that height the night would be extremely cold. I decided to follow the more important of the two streams, which very likely had its source farther away and probably in the main ridge. Thus we continued to walk. The sun set and a sharp cold wind arose. We had not found any Dokpaza huts. We began to think of stopping and making a fire in some sheltered place, to spend the night there, for the higher up we went, the more severe would be the cold. As for water, there was none save the river, far, far below us. But we could easily do without evening tea after having had such a meal as our last lunch. We were discussing the place where we might stay, when I noticed a long distance before us, on the other bank of the river, a yellowish spot which could not be autumnal foliage, because we were above the zone of the trees, and which, I felt, was neither a rock nor any natural object, but a thing made by man, maybe a thatched roof. Curiosity, rather than real hope, prompted us, and we walked quickly forward instead of camping. Gradually the spot became bigger, but we still could not see clearly what it was. A little later it appeared as thatch raised on beams. It was a roof, then. The Dokpa's camp, when at last we confronted it across the stream, we realized that it was not a roof, but merely straw that had been put high up on some crossed beams to prevent the wild beasts, antelopes, and others, feeding on it during the winter, when the camp was abandoned. We felt a little disappointed. No matter, I said to Yongdan. It is worthwhile taking the trouble to go down to the river and climb up the opposite bank. We will get a few bundles of that straw down, build a kind of shelter with them and spread some as mattresses on the frozen ground. That will keep us warm. We will also fill our pot with water when crossing the stream, and make some good tea. It was a long way to the bottom of the gorge, and then up dot again by an exceedingly steep slope to the encampment. But we reaped the full reward of our toil, for, to our happy astonishment, we discovered on a small headland a real camp with a number of roofed pens for the cattle, and in one of them a separate place for the use of the men. It had a hearth, and dried cow dung lay in abundance all over the camp. We had reached a paradise. Most probably we were the only human beings on that hill, but not forgetting the warning we had been given about robbers, before we slept we set a kind of a trap between ourselves and the entrance. A man entering the hut could not have taken three steps without catching his feet in one or another of the ropes, stretched invisibly near the ground, and on his falling the noise would have awakened us. What mattered most was to avoid being taken by surprise. Once awakened well, we each had a revolver and that still better weapon, in the east, and perhaps everywhere, at winged words of the divine Ulysses and the artificers of the goddess Juno. I relied more on these latter for my safety than on anything else, and the day was near when they would justify the confidence I placed in them by giving me the victory over a gang of Pippa's brigands. In spite of the cold wind which made me shiver, I remained a long time outside, wandering through that summer resort of the wilds, beautifully lighted by an enormous full moon. How happy I was to be there, en route for the mystery of these unexplored heights, alone in the great silence, tasting the sweets of solitude and tranquility, as a passage of the Buddhist scripture has it. We ought to have left the Dokpaza camp in the middle of the night to cross the pass at noon. But we were tired, and the warmth that we felt, lying next to a big fire, kept us sleeping longer than we had planned. I shrank also from the idea of starting without eating and drinking hot tea, for on the higher level we would find no fuel. What would happen? What would the road be like? We could not guess. Was the pass even practicable? People had only told us that it might be. Yongdan, of course, felt reluctant to go so far to fetch water, inasmuch as the few places where the stream flowed freely in daytime might be covered with ice after dark. Anyhow, he went, and we drank our tea. But the day broke before WC had left the place. Later in the morning we reached Talatsa, which, from a distance, we had taken as marking the top of the pass. Behind it extended a completely barren valley enclosed between a high ridge of crumbling reddish stones on one side, and perpendicular cliffs of various pretty greyish and mauve shades on the other. In the middle of this valley we again saw the river, the water of which we had drunk at our breakfast. It fell nearly straight down in a narrow gorge from the upper valley to the lower one. I looked for traces of DOCPA's summer encampments, Athos low stone walls forming enclosures in which cattle are penned, but there were none. I could understand from the barrenness of the landscape that cattle were probably never brought so high. A nearly straight reddish line, the sharp summit of a ridge it seemed, overlooked the horizon at the end of that desolate valley. The distance, without being considerable, appeared great enough to people descending with loads on their backs, in the rarefied air of these high-altitude air. Still, the hope of seeing the end of the climb gave us courage, and we endeavored to accelerate our pace. One thing, however, made me uneasy. I did not discover any lhasa on that ridge, and Tibetans never fail to erect at least one, at the top of a pass. The explanation came when we had reached the point from which we had supposed that we would descend the opposite side of the mountain. How could I express what we felt at that moment? It was a mixture of admiration and grief. We were at the same time wonder-stricken and terrified. Quite suddenly an awe-inspiring landscape, which had previously been shut from our sight by the walls of the valley, burst upon us. Think of an immensity of snow, an undulating tableland limited far away at our left by a straight wall of blue-green glaciers and peaks wrapped in everlasting, immaculate whiteness. At our right extended a wide valley which ascended in a gentle slope until we reached the neighboring summits on the skyline. In front, a similar but wider stretch of gradually sloping ground vanished in the distance, without our being able to discern whether it led to the pass or to another tableland. Words cannot give an idea of such winter scenery as we saw on these heights. It was one of those overpowering spectacles that make believers bend their knees, as before the veil that hides the supreme face. But Yongdan and I, after our first admiration had subsided, only looked at each other in silence. No talk was needed, we clearly understood the situation. Which was the way? We did not know. It could just as well be to our right, as ahead of us. The snow did not allow one to see any trace of a trail. It was already late in the afternoon, and to miss the road meant to remain wandering all night on these frozen summits. We had a sufficient experience of mountaineering in Tibet to know what it would mean. Our exploration would be ended at its first step, and the explorers would never live to tell their tale. I looked at my watch. It was 3 in the afternoon. We had still several hours of daylight before us, and, happily, the moon would shine brightly at night. We had not yet cause to be really alarmed. The important thing was to avoid missing the road and to make haste. I looked once more at the valley on our right, then decided, let us proceed straight forward. And so we went. I grew excited and, although the snow became deeper and deeper, I walked rather quickly. We had not been able to follow the advice of the Tasitsi villagers and carry much food with us. Our host could only sell us a small quantity of sampa. His neighbors had hardly enough for themselves. They informed us that we could buy some from the servants of the Ponpo. To avoid giving them cause to talk, we had said that we would go to the Zong early the next morning, which, of course, we didn't. My bag was, therefore, rather light, whereas Yongdan, carrying the tent, its iron pegs, and sundries, was much more heavily loaded. I forged quickly ahead. Dominated by the idea of reaching the top of the pass, or of discovering if we were going in a wrong direction, I tramped with the utmost energy through the snow that reached my knees. Was the lama far behind? I turned to look at him. Never shall I forget the sight, far, far below. Amidst the white silent immensity, a small black spot, like a tiny Lilliputian insect, seemed to be crawling slowly up. The disproportion between the giant glacier range, that wild and endless slope, and the two puny travelers who had ventured alone in that extraordinarily phantasmagoric land of the heights, impressed me as it had never done before. An inexpressible feeling of compassion moved me to the bottom of my heart. It could not be possible that my young friend, the companion of so many of my adventurous travels, should meet his end in a few hours on that hill. I would find the pass, it was my duty. I knew that I would. There was no time for useless emotion. Evening was already beginning to dim the shining whiteness of the landscape. We ought by then to have been far beyond and below the pass. I strode on, now through the snowfield, jumping sometimes with the help of my long staff, proceeding I could not say how, but progressing quickly. At last I discerned a white mound and emerging from it, branches on which hung flags covered with snow and fringed with ice. It was the Letse, the top of the pass. I signaled to Jongen, who appeared still more distant and tiny. He did not see me at once, but after a while he too waved his staff. He had understood that I had arrived. There the scenery was grand beyond all description. Behind extended the waste I had crossed. In front of me was a precipitous fall of the mountain. Stretching far below, black undulating crests vanished into the darkness. The moon rose as I looked around in a trance of admiration. Its rays touched the glaciers and the high snow-robed peaks, the whole white plain, and some silvery unknown valleys toward which I was to proceed. The impassive landscape of the day seemed to awaken under the blue light which metamorphosed it. Sparks glittered to and fro, and faint sounds were wafted by the wind. Maybe elves of the frozen waterfalls, fairies of the snow, and gin-keepers of mysterious caves were to assemble and play and feast on the illuminated white tableland, or perhaps some grave council was to take place between the giants whose heads wore helmets of cold radiance. What mysteries could not have been discovered by the inquisitive pilgrim who, hidden, dared remain the motionless till dawn? Not that he could ever have related the wonder of the bewitching night, for his tongue would soon have been stiffened by the frost. Tibetans do not shout Lajido after dark. I complied with the custom and threw only in six directions the old Sanskrit mantra, Subhamastu Sarvajagatam, which means, may all beings be happy. Yongdan, who, after having understood that he neared the Letse, had taken courage and quickened his pace, caught up with me. We began to descend. Traces of a track were visible now and then, for on that side of the mountain the snow was not deep and the ground, a yellowish gravel, was often visible. What might have been the exact level of the pass we had crossed I would not venture to tell, as I could not make any observation. Still, from the comparison of the plants and various other particulars, one who has tramped for years through many mountain ranges, in the same country, may make a rough guess. I had carefully looked at the lichens, and observed a few other things, and I felt nearly certain that the pass was about 19,000 feet high, even higher perhaps than the Dokal I had crossed about 2 months before, higher than the Nagoland others that reached from 18,299 to 18,500. Although we knew that we should have to walk a part of the night before we should reach a spot where fuel would be available, we rejoiced at having found the pass open and at having crossed it safely. In this agreeable mood we reached a valley whose bottom was almost entirely covered by a frozen stream. There, on the ice, no trace of a track was of course visible, and we began again to roam to and fro in search of some sign to show us our direction. To follow the course of the frozen river was the safest way, if we did not find any better one. It would take us to a lower level, no doubt, but it could also happen that the stream would disappear into a narrow gorge or fall over a cliff. Still, I had decided to continue on the ice, at least as long as the valley was open. But then I found the track again, near the foot of the hill, and we had only to follow it down, proceeding slowly. The walk was rather agreeable beneath a beautiful moon. Here and there we began to see a few bushes scattered in pasture grounds. Otherwise the country was quite barren. We could not think of stopping without lighting a fire, for motion alone kept us warm. No shelter whatsoever was in sight, and the cold wind from the snow rushed through the valley, which had now become rather wide. We tramped until 2 o'clock in the morning. For 19 hours we had been walking, without having stopped or refreshed ourselves in any way. Strangely enough, I did not feel tired, but only sleepy. Yongden had gone in the direction of the hills in search of fuel, and I found some near the river, in a flat place, which must have been a camping place in the summer, where travelers from the Bow country go to the Danshin Pro /ns, either to trade or on robbery expeditions. I called the young man back, gathered as much fuel as I could, and, certain that nobody was wandering in that wilderness, We decided to pitch our tent in the low place among a few bushes. The flint and steel witch, according to Tibetan custom, Yongdan carried attached to his belt in a pouch, had become wet during our passage across the snowfields, and now it did not work at all. This was a serious matter. Of course, we were no longer on the top of the range and we had only a few hours to wait before the sun would rise, but even if we escaped being frozen, we were not at all certain that we should not catch pneumonia or some other serious disease. "Jetsma," said Yongdan, "you are, I know, initiated in the Thumo Rixiang practice. Warm yourself and do not bother about me. I shall jump and move to keep my blood moving." True, I had studied under two Tibetan Gompens the strange art of increasing the internal heat. For long I had been puzzled by the stories I had heard and read on the subject, and as I am of a somewhat scientific turn of mind, I wanted to make the experiment myself. With great difficulties, showing an extreme perseverance in my desire to be initiated into the secret, and after a number of ordeals, I succeeded in reaching my aim. I saw some hermits seated night after night, motionless on the snow, entirely naked, sunk in meditation, while the terrible winter blizzard whirled and hissed round them. I saw under the bright, full moon the test given to their disciples who, on the shore of a lake or a river in the heart of the winter, dried on their bodies, as on a stove, a number of sheets dipped in the icy water. And I learned the means of performing these feats. I had inured myself, during 5 months of the cold season, to wearing the single thin cotton armament of the students at a 13,000-foot level. But the experience once over, I felt that a further training would have been a waste of time for me, who, as a rule, could choose my dwelling in less severe climates or provide myself with heating apparatus, tea. Had, therefore, returned to fires and warm clothes, and thus could not be taken for an adept in the Thumo Rixiang, as my companion believed. Nevertheless, I liked at times to remember the lesson I had learned and to sit on some snowy summit in my thin dress of Rixiang. But the present was not the time to look selfishly after my own comfort. I wanted to try to kindle a fire that had nothing miraculous about it, but which could warm my adopted son as well as myself. "Go," said I to Yongdan, "collect as much dry cow dung and dry twigs as you can. The exertion will prevent you from getting cold." "I will see after the fire business," he went, convinced that the fuel was useless, but I had got an idea. After all, the flint and steel were wet and cold. What if I warmed them on me, as I had dried dripping sheets when a student of Thumo Rixiang? Thumo Rixiang is but a way devised by the Tibetan hermits of enabling themselves to live without endangering their health on the high hills. It has nothing to do with religion, and so it can be used for ordinary purposes without lack of reverence. I put the flint and steel and a pinch of the moss under my clothes, sat down, and began the ritualistic practice. I mentioned that I felt sleepy on the road, the exertion while collecting fuel and pitching the tent, the effort to kindle the fire, had shaken my torpor, but now, being seated, I began to doze. Yet my mind continued to be concentrated on the object of the Thumo. Soon I saw flames arising around me, they grew higher and higher, they enveloped me, curling their tongues above my head. I felt deliciously comfortable. A loud report awakened me. The ice on the river. The flames suddenly died down as if entering the ground. I opened my eyes. The wind was blowing hard and my body burned. I made haste. The flint and steel and moss would work this time, I was convinced of it. I was still half dreaming, although I had got up and walked toward the tent. I felt fire bursting out of my head, of my fingers. I placed on the ground a little dry pice, a small piece of very dry cow dung, and I knocked the stone. A spark sprang out of it. I knocked again, another sprang out, another miniature fireworks. The fire was lighted, it was a little baby flame which wanted to grow, to eat, to live. I fed it and it leapt higher and higher. When Yongdan arrived with a quantity of dry cow dung in the lap of his dress and some branches between his arms, he was joyfully astonished. "How have you done it?" he asked. "Well, It is the fire of Thumo, I answered, smiling. The lama looked at me. True, he said. Your face is quite red and your eyes are so bright.
Yes, I replied, that is all right.
Let me alone now, and make a good buttered tea quickly. I need a very hot drink.